morning, everybody. Aloha. Welcome to the second session of the day. I'd like to introduce Robin Giffen from the University of British Columbia, Okanagan, who's going to be speaking today on understanding the unwritten rules of unwritten language.
Good morning, or as we say in Nabbit, Ibigwe. My name's Robin, and I'm a master's student at the University of British Columbia's Okanagan campus. In my presentation today, I'll be discussing the development of the Nabbit orthography. So I'll first present my theoretical perspective, introduce the language of Nabbit, give some backgrounds to the project, and then discuss what proper letters are and how Nabbit should be spelt. So as a linguistic anthropologist, I'm interested in understanding the connection between language and culture, and in particular, how people's language ideologies, or the way that they think about their language, influences the decisions that they make. Paul Cross-Critty says that language ideologies represent the perception of language and discourse that is constructed in the interest of a specific social or cultural group. In the case of my research, I'm interested in understanding how people's language ideologies influenced the development of the Nabbit orthography. Because as Catherine Woolard notes, orthographic systems cannot be conceptualized as simply reducing speech to writing, but rather are symbols that themselves carry historical, cultural, and political meanings. With this understanding of orthographies, I endeavor to try to understand why Nabbit speakers selected certain symbols and what constitutes a proper letter by their definition. So the Nabbit language is spoken by approximately 40,000 people in the Nabdim district in the Upper East region of Ghana, which is shown in the small red circle at the top right-hand corner of the map. Nabbit is part of the Gur language family that extends across West Africa. Ghana is a linguistically diverse country with approximately 81 recognized languages, which does not include dialects. As a result, there are high levels of multilingualism, and many people speak 3, 4, or even 5 languages, which usually includes English, the national language of Ghana. There are also low levels of literacy across Ghana, but especially in rural northern Ghana, where Nabbit is spoken. So my project originated out of the work of a nonprofit organization called Project GROW, which stands for Ghana Rural Opportunities for Women. It was started by a PhD student, Vida Yakong, at UBC's Okanagan campus. Vida intended for the organization to provide economic opportunities for women in her home community in the Nabdim district of Ghana. One of the initiatives that Project GROW has started is an adult literacy program. But Nabbit speakers said that they wanted to learn literacy in both English and their indigenous language of Nabbit, which required the development of an orthography because they had not previously written their language. So I was invited to serve as the linguistic anthropologist on the project during my undergraduate degree. In the summer of 2012, I worked with Vida, the creator of Project GROW, who is a fluent Nabbit speaker and well-respected community member, to conduct a preliminary phonological documentation and analysis of the Nabbit language. Together, we also created a preliminary orthography, which you can see in the picture on the left. To the right, you can see a book that we developed, Nabbit Golhuk Ni Kaluk Baum, which means Nabbit Writing and Counting Book. We developed this book to showcase the newly developed orthography and sent it back to the community in Ghana to get feedback from other Nabbit speakers. The feedback we received led to my master's research and a continuation of the project. So in the summer of 2014, I spent 6 weeks conducting fieldwork in the Nabdim district in Ghana. I interviewed 13 speakers, 6 men and 7 women, from 6 different villages. My documentation was mainly phonological, but also included some morphological and syntactic data, as well as recording 1 story or more from each speaker. I then worked with the Nabbit Language Committee, which is comprised of 15 Nabdim community members, 10 men and 5 women, to develop an orthography for the Nabbit language. To develop the orthography, I hosted a 1-day alphabet design workshop for the Nabbit Language Committee members, though only 11 of the 15 were able to attend. During this workshop, I provided analysis of the phonology of Nabbit and suggestions for how each sound could be represented. But it was the Nabbit committee members who made the final decisions about how each sound would be represented in the orthography. In the picture on the left, you can see the Navajo Language Committee members listening attentively during the workshop. And on the right, you can see an example, although I realize chalkboard doesn't photograph well, of what I showed the committee members as we were discussing sounds. So first I would talk about the sound and then I would show them how it was represented in English and Brunei writing systems, and then what symbol we had used in the preliminary orthography. I would then provide symbol suggestions and example words so the committee could see the symbols in use. So in this case, we've got the sound P, which in Brunei, English, and the preliminary orthography, we all used the letter P. And the example word is pick, which is fog. So there are four principles which I established with the Navajo Language Committee that govern my suggestions for the Navajo orthography. First, one symbol would represent only one sound. What I mean by that is ideally, one symbol would represent only one phoneme, but could represent two allophones whenever possible. Secondly, we would establish standard spellings, but still allow for individual preference and variation in pronunciation, which means that everyone could feel free to pronounce words however they normally did, even if it varied from the agreed upon pronunciation and subsequent spelling. Thirdly, it would be easy to use and learn, as everyone from young children to the very elderly wanted to use and learn the orthography, so we wanted it to be simple. This meant limiting the use of difficult characters and diacritics. Lastly, to help facilitate the easy to use and learn principle, it was decided that we would use the Roman alphabet, which is the English language uses. This is important because the national language of Ghana is English. Anyone who goes to school is educated in English and learns to read and write English. So the more similar the Navajo orthography could be to the English alphabet, the easier the transition from one literacy to the other would be. Aside from the four principles and my linguistic analysis, there were a few other considerations I had to make when suggesting symbols for the Navajo orthography. As I mentioned previously in my description of the workshop, I showed the committee how each sound was represented in the Brunei writing system. So what's important to understand about this is that Navajo has traditionally been classified as a dialect of the Brunei language, but my research and the work of other Ghanaian language scholars suggests that Navajo is actually better classified as its own language. And this is supported by opinions of Navajo and Brunei speakers. Therefore, the committee decided to develop a distinct Navajo alphabet instead of using the Brunei orthography that was established in 2007. I was therefore careful to provide suggestions that were both similar to Brunei and different, so that the Navajo Language Committee could decide how similar or different the Navajo orthography should be from the Brunei orthography. Important to note is that the Brunei orthography was technically designed to be used by all of the dialects of Brunei, including Navajo. As well, a previous orthography had been proposed in 1975, again, to be used by all of the dialects, and many Navajo speakers told me that they had informally learned to write some Navajo words in this orthography when they were in primary school. As well, four people who are on the Navajo Language Committee have master's degrees in Brunei language education, and they were therefore able to write Navajo in the Brunei orthography. And two of these speakers, Dominic and Mr. Patrick, provided me with example documents showing me how they wrote Navajo. Additionally, my very first research partner, Vida, had used a personal orthography she developed when taking field notes conducting research in Navajo. Lastly, in their work, Angela Terrell and Michael Dunn found that speakers of their language had very particular ideas about what constituted a proper letter. Many people in the community were familiar with Roman-based writing systems, and they therefore did not like symbols from other writing systems, such as the half-O symbol from the International Phonetic Alphabet. They also were not fond of diacritics. This is common in many languages, so I prepared myself for how I would deal with these issues, particularly knowing that the English alphabet does not have enough symbols to adequately represent all of the sounds in Navajo. So in the next section, I'm going to discuss what Navajo speakers considered proper letters. So here I highlight two consonants that Navajo speakers had very particular ideas about. First, the voiced velar nasal ng. I learned very early on in my fieldwork that some Navajo speakers were already familiar with the IPA symbol. During my very first interview in Ghana with a man named Dominic, The 10th word I asked him was donkey, which he told me was bong. And when he looked over at my notes, he commended me on my use of the local character, the N with the tail. At this point, I realized that the IPA symbol would actually be pretty well received and not as contentious as it was in other languages and proposed orthographies, meaning we could use a single letter instead of the NG digraph that English uses. The other symbol that my discussion with the Nabbit Language Committee centered on was the voiced palatal nasal nya. In this case, I made two suggestions, N with a tilde or NY. Although NY technically goes against the first principle of the Nabbit orthography, I included it because it's used in many other Ghanaian orthographies. As well, NY can already be seen in other writing in the Nabdom district. In particular, the name of a Nabdom village, Nyobok, is spelt with an NY on the road sign. The committee has selected NY because even though N with a tilde would be unique and would fit well with our orthography because we were marking nasal vowels with a tilde, the familiarity and ease of a symbol that was already known was more important. Prior to beginning my fieldwork, suggesting vowels for the orthography is what I was looking forward to the least, as Nabbit has 9 vowels, though only 7 are phonemes, which cannot be adequately represented by the 5 vowels in the English alphabet. I had prepared extensive lists of suggestions for how we could use the regular E with a variety of diacritics to represent E, and O with a variety of diacritics to represent the A sound. However, I also learned early on in my fieldwork that people were familiar with the E and A IPA symbols. Nabbit speakers also considered these to be local characters. One speaker I interviewed, Bob, told me that the Ghanaian languages in general, we have particular letters for the Ghana language, whether you are writing in Twi, you are writing in Kasina, or you are writing Kusal. We are all using the same vowels and the same consonants. Although I never found any academic references to this Ghanaian alphabet, it was known by several Nabbit speakers, and I was commended in my interviews and the alphabet workshop for using these local characters, although my use was not intentional, as I was writing in the International Phonetic Alphabet. As a result, I ended up not suggesting any of the other symbols with the extensive diacritics for the orthography, and simply proposed the E and A IPA symbols, which the Nabbit Language Committee happily selected. As I mentioned previously, several other Ghanaian languages use these symbols. So just to show you a few, Akan, the largest indigenous language in Ghana, spoken mainly in southern Ghana, uses 3 of the 4 symbols. Dagbani, spoken in the northern region, uses all 4 of these symbols. And both of the Gruny orthographies, the proposed from 1975 and the official from 2007, use these 4 symbols. There are also 3 spelling rules that seem to predate the development of the Nabbit orthography, which I had to address. The first is adding an E at the end of words ending with R. For example, while we were discussing the word nor, meaning mouth, one of the Nabbit Language Committee members suggested that I add an E to the end of the word when I wrote it on the board. Another speaker, Mr. Patrick, was very opposed to this. He said, "Yes, but this R sound is already there, nor. You see, but if you add the E or any other vowel, then you've changed it, because if you add E, it would be nore, and it's not nore, it's just nor." Another speaker, Vida, joined the conversation and said, "But the E might be silent," to which Mr. Patrick responded, "If it is silent, what is the use of putting it there?" Another similar spelling rule was to add I to words ending with H. So the plural marker for animals is to add a H sound at the end of the word. For example, the word for dog is ba, and the word dogs is ba. When I wrote this word on the board, several speakers suggested I spell it B-A-H-I instead of just B-A-H. Although it's not entirely clear where these 2 spelling rules came from, Mr. Patrick, who was opposed to these spellings, suggested that people might think R and H could not stand on their own and needed a word final vowel. Alternatively, it could also be a rule brought over from English, as several words end in R-E, such as core, spelled C-O-R-E, or snore, S-N-O-R-E. Regardless of where they came from, I needed to address these somewhat strange spellings. So I reminded the committee of our first principle, that each symbol represents one sound. And if we're going to teach people that the E represents the sound A, then writing at the end of a word means people should be pronouncing it. So as Mr. Patrick had already pointed out, spelling mouth with an E at the end should be pronounced nore, and we want people to just say nor. As well, we don't want people to add an I to dogs because we want people to say bah, not bahi. The Nabbit Language Committee agreed to change these spellings, but they're surprisingly well established for a language without a writing system. And when we began to practice, several committee members still added E's and I's to words where they were not pronounced. I think this is something that's going to happen for a while. The last spelling rule is that there's a habit to drop unstressed vowels. For example, the word for fire is usually pronounced bugum, with an unstressed second vowel. So some people spelled it B-U-G-M instead of B-U-G-U-M. When I discussed it with the committee, we decided that the true form of the word was boo-gum. Therefore, the vowel should be written. Again, the committee agreed to write it this way. However, several people handed in to me papers spelling it B-U-G-M in their suggestions for the dictionary. So just a few notes about the final Nabbit orthography that we developed. It has 53 symbols, and of those symbols, only one is actually unique from Grunay, the NW. It represents a sound that does not exist in Grunay. In total, there are 24 consonant symbols, 24 vowel symbols, and 5 diphthong symbols. Also worth noting is that the orthography has 5 digraph symbols, meaning 2 letters representing one sound. So what did these orthographic decisions that the Nabbit Language Committee made tell us about the language ideologies that they hold? Well, firstly, it shows us that Nabbit speakers had very strong opinions about how Nabbit should be written, and that they wanted to be included in the discussion about writing. Specifically, Nabbit speakers held ideas about writing that extended far beyond linguistic representation. Although we did discuss the importance of symbols representing particular sound, all of the orthographic discussions I presented here focused on non-linguistic factors like identity and social context. The letters that were deemed as proper were valued for Ghanaian identity. In particular, this demonstrates that Nabbit speakers felt attached to the pre-existing local characters, and the desire to include these characters in the Nabbit orthography shows that Nabbit speakers identify with the greater Ghana community. In fact, this connection to Ghana as a whole was stronger than the desire to develop a unique orthography, as choosing to use all of the local characters meant Nabbit was using the same symbols as Grunay, rather than developing a distinct orthography. Secondly, the pre-existing spelling conventions demonstrate that Nabbit speakers were already writing, and again, thinking about writing. It also helps to highlight the fact that Nabbit speakers are influenced by a number of other languages and their orthographies, which ended up being an incredibly important consideration in the orthography development and standardization of spelling. So how can this be applied in a wider context of orthography development? First, we need to understand that there's no such thing as starting from scratch. Even when working with a language that has never been documented or written, speakers might still be familiar with what other orthographies could very well, symbols they use, and they might very well have incredibly developed ideas about how they want their language represented in writing. This therefore requires us to consider factors beyond linguistic analysis when developing orthographies, including social, cultural, historical, and political ideas. To return to Catherine Woolard, orthographies carry social meaning, so let's consider that meaning when we develop the alphabet. It's especially important to recognize the attitudes and opinions of speakers to ensure that they are represented in the orthography. Lastly, we need to remember that there's no such thing as a perfect orthography. Even though I advocated very strongly for the use of only single letters, not digraphs, the Nabbit Language Committee chose to include 5, meaning the orthography, in some way, violates one of our founding principles. But in the end, it's better to have developed an orthography that I know the community identifies with and will use than an orthography that perfectly correlates to my linguistic analysis that no one would ever write in. We need to value the opinions of language community members' conceptions of proper and correct above our own. With that, I'd like to say mpopya, or thank you, to my Nabbit language collaborators, my supervisor, and the organizations that supported me financially. Thank you for listening.
Knowing a little bit about Gur languages, I would guess that Nabbit is in a transition in terms of adjusting the way the noun class system is marked on the ends of the words. And so for some speakers, those vowels actually might be more present. And there, and maybe it's not a vowel, but especially that H. That H is strange in Gur. And for other Gur languages, there's something at the end of the word, but it's really hard to find and really hard to identify.
Yeah.
So I think, and especially the M ending as well, because those historically, I would guess, were class markers because they line up with other class markers in other group languages.
Yeah.
Just consider the, my point is, language as it's always in transition, your orthography actually can be adaptable for those different.
Yeah. Interestingly, one of the other researchers who works on Gurney said that Nabbit is different because Nabbit has a tendency to drop the final syllable in some words. And so I considered that and I started asking people, what if I said bahi with the vowel? And every single person told me that I sounded ridiculous. So there is a potential that it used to be there, but we did decide that it was better to not write it because people would pronounce it. And at this point in time, that pronunciation is deemed incorrect. Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. So if they're familiar with the IPA symbols, historically, what did you find about the orthography? Like, what had been done with the orthography before you started working on it?
Mm-hmm. So the 1975 orthography was proposed by Robert Schaefer, who is an SIL linguist. And they did a translation of the New Testament, but it's not widely circulated. Currently, Ghana has a mother tongue language education policy that says that children can be educated in their indigenous language for the first 3 years of school. It hasn't been particularly well implemented because of the requirement of a standard orthography and curriculum. And so, interestingly, I didn't really mention it in this talk, but Gurney and Nabbit taken together are considered an endangered language, sort of right at that threatened threshold. There's still intergenerational transmission and L1 speakers, but people are transitioning heavily to English. Nabbit, as we're sort of working to separate it as its own language, is actually threatened more so by Gurney than it is by English. And so there are Gurney scholars who are working very hard to get Gurney into the language, as a language into the schooling. And on the one hand, we're sort of trying to piggyback on their tailcoats. And on the other hand, we're saying, this is great, let's do this, but not in our communities. In our communities, let it be just Nabbit. So currently, when children go to school, they're only educated in English. But a lot of teachers informally write words, and I saw that in schools when I was there, but they're not properly taught writing.
So are the children speaking Nabbit?
Mm-hmm.
And the teachers, are they also Nabbit speakers?
Sometimes, but not really. This is a very rural area. Not a lot of people want to teach there, so when you get out of teacher training college, you kind of get sent somewhere for about 3 years and do your due diligence before you get back to a real school in the city.
So I wondered if the native teachers you got to observe in the classroom, is that right? And were they doing explanations to the students in the L1? Were they?
Occasionally. They try to avoid it also because a lot of them aren't familiar with Nabbit. And they're not supposed to. It's very frowned upon. There's actually I have a great photograph of a school, and printed on the side of the school in big capital letters, it says, "Speak English." Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Using IPA letters, you may have technical problems because the keyboards, you have to adapt the keyboards. So is it a problem for them to use that? And also, designing an orthography, it doesn't only have to do with the sounds. You also have to take into account the grammar. It depends on the grammar you have. Working with a language where the morphology is very rich, we had to take into account, you know, the relation between words and things like that. So it's not only a question of sounds, mm-hmm. but sometimes you have to take into account the morphology and the morphology.
Mm-hmm. So we did discuss with our ease of use whether or not we wanted symbols that aren't easily typed. It really wasn't even a concern for people, as I said. There was no way that they were going to use symbols other than these Ghanaian symbols, regardless of the complication of typing. Mostly right now, people are writing by hand, and particularly in the schools, it's all on a chalkboard, and so that was fine. And the speakers that I was working with, the ones who had master's degrees, they all just downloaded the Unicode font on their computer and had no problems with it. I anticipate when people start to use texting that there is going to be a shift. I mean, people use their phones and text, but once the Nabbit language shifts into that domain, I anticipate that we're going to see the E and the O representing A and E and O and A. So we'll be curious to see what happens with that. Mm-hmm. And also, you make a good point. Once we started writing, I realized that the words, the word breaks were not where I thought they were. People were adding way more prefixes and suffixes where I thought that they were separate words. It didn't actually affect it too much, but it was interesting to note that later. At the back. Yeah.
I was wondering what kind of projects did the teachers have for the future of the writing system? Would you say that the main goal was to assert the Nabbit as a separate language? Or do they have specific things that they want to write about?
So both. Nabbit speakers in the committee in particular, we discussed the fact that Nabbit is not the same as Grune, and that's part of what my thesis is looking at. So we're hopeful that having a separate orthography, although, as I mentioned, it's not that different, will help us establishing Nabbit as a separate language. People do want to read and write in Nabbit. In my interviews with speakers, I actually included an entire sort of qualitative section where I asked people, what do you want to be able to write? Why is it important to you to have a Nabbit writing system? And people told me the number one thing they want to be able to write is things relating to Nabbit culture. They want to write Nabbit stories. They want to write about their traditions, how they farm, what their inheritance processes are like, how they do funerals. And in particular, they want to write that in Nabbit. They don't want to write it in English. The day that I finished my second interview, people asked me when I was coming back to do a PhD. So there are things they want written, and they're ready for it.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for highlighting this idea that there is more than just representation of sounds in an alphabet. I think it's very important because purely phonetic alphabets sometimes are not very practical in use. So there is more to other than just sounds in the alphabet. And my question is, I wonder if you considered the mathematical formula for creating an alphabet that was, I believe, designed in the 20s or 30s in the Soviet Union when dozens of alphabets were created for previously unwritten languages. I think it's based on the correlation between the number of consonants and vowel phonemes. So I just don't know if that's known in the, whatever, in the, among the scholars doing that research and creating alphabets for African languages.
Mm. It's not something that I've heard of, and it's not something I considered. I did have a bit of a chuckle to myself, though, when I saw that there were 24 vowels, thinking how English has only 26 letters in total. but that's quite standard, because there are four four types of vowels because they carry length and tone. But when I showed the committee this very long alphabet of 53 letters, that no one was surprised or cared about how many symbols there were. So.
One quick question.
So in this regard, you consider, it's hard to see from the back, but I'm assuming those marks above the characters are tone marks?
Yeah.
Do you consider those then a high tone versus a no tone, or is that a high tone, mid tone, low tone?
So those are, it doesn't show well at the back. Those are actually tildes, so it's nasalization.
Okay.
So there's regular, there's long, there's nasal, and then there's long nasal.
And you're not marking.
So I was sort of avoiding this after the last presentation, but there is tone. It is a tonal language, but there are very few tones in words that actually cause a difference in meaning. And almost always you can tell what the word is based on the context in the sentence. So we decided to keep it simple, and we're only marking tone when absolutely necessary. But there is a high tone, a low tone, and contour.
So in this orthography, the nasalization vowels are considered separate letters.
Yeah, they cause a difference in meaning, and so we have minimal pairs of all four. So we decided that we would include every single variation
and
in the orthography.
You're not teaching the tilde as its own letter that is applied to a second letter, you're teaching it as a unit.
As a unit. Mm-hmm.
Many thanks, Robin. Thank you.